Welcome to Southern Steep, the public health and social justice podcast brought to you by NASTAD. Much like brewing stronger tea, this platform aims to brew stronger community by censoring the voices of community leaders and their innovative work in the Southern United States. Welcome, everyone. I'm Bianca Ward, joined by the amazing Isaiah Webster III. Hi, Isaiah.
Hey, Bianca. It's been a minute since I've been on with you. Did you listen to that episode that Tori and I did? I think it was early March, where he was throwing shade at you and Nicole.
You know what? I listened, the level of petty, then I turned it off, and then I went back to listen because I'm a professional. But Nicole and I did an amazing episode together to, I was about to say combat, that's not the word, to rival the episode that you and Torian did.
Yeah, I get kind of lost in the numbers, but I think today you and I are recording maybe episode 9 or 10, depending on the sequencing. And it's been a lot of fun to work on this podcast with you all. So I'm thrilled. And I'm trying to stay warm because it's really cold today.
I was just going to say, what's one word to describe how you're feeling today?
Chilled. So my calendar says that it's going to be spring next week, but my body says, no, ma'am.
Fair. This is the spring of deception in this area, so we shall see. But speaking of spring, look, how am I going to segue that? Speaking of things that bring me bright joy, like I did that there, I'm really, really excited about today's guest. So for a while now, I have been referring to folks that work in public health as professional superheroes because we are literally out here saving the lives and hopefully making money doing so or being paid to do what we are passionate about. And I think today's guest, Khadija, is literally the definition of professional superheroes. So I'm really excited to talk about her and her work and the amazing things that she has been doing in the South and Fork community. So before we jump into that, I'm going to tell a little bit about Khadija from her very fancy bio. Khadija is a public health professional, entrepreneur, activist, and seeker of doing good. Yes, y'all, seeker of doing good. She is the founder of Reaching All HIV Positive Muslims in America, RAMA, a nonprofit that addresses HIV, female genital mutilation, cutting, sexual health, and gender-based violence in faith communities through education, advocacy, and empowerment. Khadija is also the founder of the federally recognized National Faith HIV/AIDS Awareness Day and Playtime Event Sitters, a premier on-site wedding and event childcare service. Most recently, Khadija joined the Launch Good team to connect Muslims with amazing crowdfunding platform to help amplify their causes. She is also a faith ambassador with the COVID-19 Prevention Network and engages faith communities of color in conversations around effects of COVID-19, disparities, prevention efforts, and effective community response. Literally a professional superhero. Hi, Khadija.
Hi. You know what? People ask for my bio. They don't read the whole thing. So I was like, well, she's reading every word.
I am giving all of the flowers today. People need to know all of the, like, literally all of the things that you've been doing for a community. And not only that, but just an entrepreneur at the same time. We're going to get into kind of how you balance all of these amazing hats that you are wearing, but you do it so well. And it's just been really phenomenal to see, I think, especially. So I've known you for a while and kind of always been following your work and applauding. But at the same time, I think during COVID, it has been awesome to see you really advocate for community and reach out around prevention and wellness for community. So I am excited. And folks need to get into all of the things that you're doing. So yes, I'm going to read every word.
Well, thank you. I know you mentioned that it's supposed to be spring. Like Isaiah, I have a little heater on right now because it is cold. I went outside for a second right before this call, and I was like, "Woof!" I had my jacket on. It looks like this evening. It's like nice and sunny, but it's not that
lies.
Warm.
Lies, all of it.
Now, have you ever been on a podcast before?
I would guess, yeah. Yeah, I've been on a few.
Could have been a celebrity.
I've been on a lot. I mean, is it considered a podcast? But
she's like, what are you talking about? I do this all the time.
But I've been on a couple.
But, we're excited to have you. So tell us your why. How did you first get into public health?
Yeah. So I wanted to be a nurse at first. My aunts are nurses. People in my family are nurses. I wanted to always help people. So I studied to be a nurse, and I was working at a hospital as a student nurse. So I was working there, learning a lot on the job. I felt I learned a lot better doing things hands-on than always like reading textbooks and all that type of thing. So I was working there part-time, and one day we had this patient come in, and you know, he was a Muslim man, identified as Muslim. And he wasn't very nice to the nurses or the staff, but he was like angry about something. And I was like, well, I don't want to be his aide because I don't have to deal with that. So I thought in my head. So of course, one day I come to work, and guess who was assigned to the patient?
Gotcha.
Me. So I'm like, okay. So, you know, I get his chart, and you know, as you're looking at his chart, you see what he's in for. And actually, he had developed into the age stage. And so I went in there and I said, I'm here to help, you know, what can I do to make you feel comfortable here? And like, he gave me this look, like, you know, just gave me this look. And I felt like he was looking into my soul, the way that he's looking at me. And I was like, okay. But then he started talking. And like, over time, we built, like, I would say, a relationship, I mean, much you can with a patient, but a relationship. So, and you know, he opened up and he told me like he didn't feel welcome in the Muslim community because of his HIV status, that he didn't feel like he needed to go there and, you know, feel safe. And people don't talk about it in the community. It's not something that's really discussed. And it made me think about it. I was like, you know what? You know, growing up, we didn't discuss sexual health, forget HIV or AIDS. So it kind of really opened my eyes to what the struggles he was going through, the challenges. And it made me just think, you know, I have something about this. I have to start talking about this. When I was in high school, we had this male living with AIDS come to our homeroom and talk to us. And I felt so disgusted as a high school kid. I was like, why is he here? I'm going to catch AIDS by breathing the same air as him. Because I was very ignorant and I didn't have any understanding of HIV or AIDS. So as I got into college, I met a Muslim. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, this affects anybody. It doesn't matter what your faith is, your background, who you are. And then I found out later, my friend who was 19 years old was also positive. So it really got me going. So I went to my college campus, you know, organized the first AIDS Awareness Week. We had people come from local nonprofits, people who live in HIV share information and even their stories that they wanted to do that. It wasn't required, but they wanted to share, they did. We had videos, we had testing, we gave out condoms, we had sexual health information. We focused on the Latino community, the African community, the Black community. We had a nice ball. We dressed up and danced and had food. So it was a really engaging week. But then I realized that my passion was more around community health and public health, more so than working in a hospital as a nurse. So, but of course I had this limited perception back then, like, oh, a nurse only works in the hospital. Like, you know, I didn't think about working in like other settings as well. So I changed my major to public health. Got a degree in that, and I started volunteering at a local nonprofit, AIDS Clinic in New Haven. It was run by Chris Cole, and he became my mentor, and I really started like learning more HIV and AIDS. And I moved to DC while I was still in school and interned at NMAC. And I was there the first day at NMAC, they sent me to Capitol Hill to go to a briefing by myself. I was like, what? So I was sitting there in the briefing, they're asking me who I was. I was like, well, my first day as an intern, but this is what I know about NMAC. And I just shared it. But ever since then, I've been in the HIV field. And around 2012, I wanted to start Rahma. I wanted to start an organization that focused on the Muslim community. And Rahma is the Arabic word for mercy. So with mercy and compassion as our guide, I really want to find a way to address stigma and create a safe space for all. And as I was doing it over the years, you know, it came to mind, like, of course, HIV and AIDS affects all faith communities. So we kind of transitioned out to this Muslim community, so all the faith communities. And we go by Rahma now, more so than reaching all, like, the whole name. So, yeah, that's how I got started.
I think that's amazing. Rahma, did I pronounce it correctly? And if I mispronounce it, I want you to correct me on
the spot. No, it's fine. You did it.
Okay. So I have two questions, and forgive me for asking them, but they're kind of connected. So when I was looking at your website this week, preparing for, you know, our time together, I noticed that you did a conference recently on for South Asian women. And I wanted to know first if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, because I'm curious about that. But also, I would love to get your take on the hate crimes that we're seeing among the Asian community right now. And just, if you could just, I'll just put it like that, and I'll just ask for your thoughts.
So come back to our site in about 2 weeks. We're having a whole new site built, and it'll be released with a lot more information, a lot more stuff going on there. We have actually a whole new logo and everything. But for the South Asian Conference, so we got a small grant through the mayor's office in DC from the Asian and Pacific Islander office. And so the focus is on Asian Americans. So with our work with FGM/C prevention and other things, we had a connection with the South Asian community. And people on our team that are South Asian. And we also know we actually work with people who are living with HIV that are South Asian. So, and we know there's stigma in the community, especially, and sometimes it comes to culture, are different things that, you know, that come up in their community. So I wanted to have a conference that was a space for South Asian women to come together and talk about these different things. So we had it last Saturday. It was virtual because of COVID, but people attended, and we did it with our partners, HEART, which is a South Asian-led sexual health organization based in Chicago, and with Saheyo, which is the South Asian-led FGM/C prevention organization. And the founder is based in Boston. So we did an all-day conference on HIV and AIDS, sexual health, FGM/C. We did it through a South Asian lens. I didn't lead a conference. One of my team members did. She's South Asian. So she led a conference from our team. And we discussed, you know, barriers, stigma, stereotypes, how we can have these conversations. They're difficult sometimes. How can we keep our South Asian identity with us as we do this work? How can we talk to our community, you know? And we had these conversations, and now like more than half of the team want to volunteer with us now, like help us build. I'm like, yes, we need this, because we want to keep building and continue growing and reaching more people. So now we're trying to work with them to do volunteer-wise and how we can build more programs, reach more people. And we're going to come up with a PSA probably in a month or two featuring some of the attendees, like calling out to their community to step up and address stigma and raise awareness and make noise. So look forward to that coming out soon. And we're creating a conversation guide that people can use to have these conversations in their community from a South Asian lens. So we're building this out through this grant. And this is why you see it's focused on community, because what the grant is for. But we also know there's a need for that. Like maybe a couple of years ago, we had someone call us, and they were connected to a family who was South Asian, and they found out their daughter was HIV positive, but they didn't know what to do. They didn't want anybody to know. They didn't want to send them to any organization who might find out. They want them to go to any medical treatment because of the stigma they were fearful of. And it just shows the need to have education and to create a safe space, because, you know, people should be able to access the care without fear. So that's one thing that came up when we talked about this conference. And we also have scenarios too. We presented to the attendees based on South Asian culture and then finding out different things about their health. So yeah, it was a really engaging conference. We got a lot of great feedback. We also got some recommendations on how to improve it too, which is really great, because we want to learn, like, what can we do better to make it even more engaging and more, you know, just more better next time. Mm-hmm. So we worked on that too. So yeah.
So NASA has done work on stigma for a long time, and I've been privileged to kind of be involved in that work. One of the questions that I get from community all the time is, how can we evaluate whether or not our stigma reduction efforts are being are doing what we want them to do? Like, how do we know that they're working? As someone who does quite a bit of work with the Muslim community around stigma, when you're asked, how can we know that it's working? Or how can we prove or evaluate that our stigma reduction efforts are working? How do you tackle that question?
Yes. And I forgot to mention, you asked me before about how to react to the Asian hate that has happened.
Yes. Like, yes.
I have to answer that. Obviously we're appalled. No one deserves to be triggered or, you know, even killed in their space of work or business and get their nails done. Like, it's just something that shouldn't be happening. And of course, it makes me think about Black lives as well. Like, we think about these things that are triggered based on our ethnicity and our background. And I think it's great that people are coming together, you know, saying stop Asian hate, you know, support Asian community, because it's important. Like, when things like this happen, we should be there for each other. And then I've seen some other things on media talking about some. We didn't see the same kind of support for Black people when it happened to us. And, you know, I see both sides of that. But for me, like, my main thing is that we're here, you know, we support. This is not something that should be happening. What can we do to help? And as part of working with the DC Mayor Office for South Asian, or just Asian in general, community, they released a statement actually themselves about it. And it's just sad that we live in a world we can't even go to the nail salon. We can't go for a job. We can't go to sleep at night. It's sad that we live in a world like this. And I think that we really need to come together and address racism in our world. But how can we do it? Because people know not to be racist, but they still are. And now we have to fear for our lives in many different ways because this is happening. So,
yeah, that's very well said.
Yeah, all we can do is keep moving forward and trying to provide support and listening to people that are from the community that want to share, and then also not put the burden on them to tell us how not to be racist. Like, we see this happening with Black folks. The people ask us, well, come to our meetings, lead a session. It's not our job to tell you not how to be racist. It's your job to know how not to be racist.
That part.
Okay, so it's like, why are you telling me to come talk to your people? Go to Google. You know how not to be, you know how to be kind. You know how to be loving. I should have to teach you how to be that, you know? So right now, I see the call is falling on Asian shoulders. Oh, come to our conference, come to our talk, tell us how we can support your community, what we can and cannot do, how can we not have this happen again? Don't go in a salon and shoot nobody, period. you know, it's very simple. So, yeah. And then you asked me, how do we measure stigma and if it's working?
Yeah, because I was curious about, you know, because we get that question a lot, and I was just, and it's always a tough question for me to answer candidly. Mm-hmm. And I always, when I have a chance to ask other folks who are working on stigma how they answer I take the opportunity.
It's varied ways. So, for example, with the South Asian Conference, what we did, of course, we had the pre-test and the post-test, and then we actually had a meeting right before this meeting going over like a recap of what went well, analyzing everything. So what you kind of do in a couple of months is reach back out to the attendees and see what they have been doing. Have they been able to have conversations? Do they feel it was easier to have conversations? How was the response to the people they were talking to? And then if they're using information they learned to kind of address if things are coming out that are inappropriate or misconceptions, if there's what they learned or their new knowledge to kind of talk about with their, you know, peers or their families to see if you can actually provide accurate information. That's one way, because you can address stigma through education. That's the main thing. So if you're educating people to do that and then you follow up and see how they're doing and see it actually working, it's a way to measure it. So you kind of do that. And then the Muslim community, we just see it working by people having more conversations about it and asking us to do more programs around it and be more receptive. So let me tell you this. Maybe back 5 years ago at an event, and we had this table, like we were, it's like a conference. And we had this booth where, like, you know, make sure you have to test your knowledge on HIV, all these different things. And this man came up to the booth and he was like, oh, that don't affect us. I was like, what you mean? He was like, yeah, it only happens in, you know, Africa. And he's like a little, this bill. I was like, what? I was so confused. And I was like, no, it doesn't
matter. Clearly so was he.
But, you know, I kept my professional composure. Mm-hmm. I was like, no, that's not correct. And I explained to him how this works. And he said, he said there's a space in Africa. It's like a community that everyone there is just, they don't have anything, he said, because he, like, I forgot how he explained it, but it didn't make a lot of sense. So So it kind of tells you people's perceptions and their thought process. And one time also I did a workshop, and they told us we only have people who are having sex or people who are sinning and things like that, which we hear is a very common narrative in many faith communities, mm-hmm. or even in general. Mm-hmm. So we had to address that and talk about that. But then people come out and say, I learned something new today. I know now that to say these words. So some words are very stigmatizing, and just saying like different words that people use sometimes that aren't, you know, language matters, right? So I kind of give them ideas and being like don't say infected sometimes, because people don't like that word.
Exactly. You
know? But say living with, or okay. You know, something like that. Because people think, am I a zombie? Am I infected? Like, am I like the Walking Dead? People say that sometimes. So it's like, don't use certain words because it can be triggering. And don't ask people, you know, what is their story? How to become positive? It's not none of your business. What you need to do is figure out how you can support them. Mm-hmm. How you can address stigma. How you yourself can be an advocate for change and educate. So I kind of have those things too. And then also, if someone decides they want to tell you their status, how do you react? How do you respond? Don't say, how'd you get it? Or what you was doing. No, that's not how you respond to somebody. So giving those scenarios and like support and like tips can help. Like, for example, it's, I always tell the story every single time. So you might have heard it before, Bianca, but we had this Muslim man. So you know, Ramadan is our holy month. Actually, it's coming up next month. And we fast for a month from sunrise to sunset. So, you know, this is a time with like the month of mercy. We're asking God for forgiveness. We're asking him for things that we want. We're praying to him. You know, we're doing acts of charity. We're giving back to the community. We're giving money to the poor, like even more so than before. We're being kind to everyone. We're cooking, we're eating a lot of different people. And it's kind of hard now with COVID. You can't like do all that, but what we used to do. So anyway, when you break fast, it's called iftar, which means literally break fast. It's usually around sunset. So usually Muslims gather in the masjid sometimes, and people like every night someone different is cooking, or the masjid provides the food. So we had this man, he was serving, helped make plates to give to the people who were breaking fast. And someone knew he was HIV positive, and they disclosed his status. People were afraid to take food from him because they were afraid they would catch HIV by touching the same spoon that he touched or the same place that he touched. And that really shows you how intense stigma and ignorance is. He didn't want to go back there. He felt so ashamed. He felt like, you know, people is out at him and they treated him like he was, you know, not even human. So he, you know, he sent me the story and he said, I don't go back there. I don't feel welcome there. They're, you know, they treat me like I was just some type of animal. And it made you think like, this is why we need this work. This is why we have to address stigma. And we measure this now by having masjids. So for example, we had a masjid last year that actually had us come into the space, and at Juma, they asked us to come up in front of the whole congregation and talk about our work. And so I didn't go up. I had one of our members grew up, and he disclosed by the whole masjid. Everyone stopped dead. That's like, what did it stop dead in their tracks? And he was able to talk to them about, yes, Muslims are living HIV too. This does affect us. It's what you can do to help. So it shows that things are changing. We have masjids willing to let you come in and talk about it. Before, we had people in masjids that were, you know, I would say abusive mm-hmm. to other members and causing trauma to other members because they didn't know how to react on the spot. But I think it's been a big, big step. And we measure it this way. You don't always measure it with data and like numbers and writing things out. Sometimes we measure it visually, what we see and what happens in the community.
And I love that, because I think sometimes it's those stories, those experiences, again, what you see that is life-changing, that brings about more conversations, you know, more kindness, more opportunities to talk about the stigma in communities, in faith spaces. And so that kind of leads me to our next topic, another amazing thing that you are doing. Tell us a little bit about Faith HIV AIDS Awareness Day and how that was born, if you will.
Yeah. So with Rockwell, my original goal was to work in the Muslim community. But, you know, we know that stigma is real in all faith communities when it comes to HIV. And along the way, I've met more people from different backgrounds. So working in HIV field, generally, I don't see too many Muslims in it anyway. So I work a lot with the Christian community in the faith aspect of HIV and AIDS. So I met many of them along the way. They were very supportive of Brahma's work and, you know, so on and so forth. So I was like, you know what, instead of having just focus on one faith, focus on all faiths. So kind of like the idea of Faith Awareness Day was to address HIV stigma in all faith communities. And we focus on eight, but we know there's a lot more faiths than eight. We know people are spiritual, we know all that. So, but we decided to focus on eight for Faith Awareness Day and people who are spiritual. And we focus on the Muslim community, Christian community, Jewish community, Buddhist community, Baha'i community, Sikh, Hindu. Who am I missing? But we focus on eight different faiths. I'm trying to remember all in my head right now. And we had this beautiful logo that had all their different faith symbols on it. And the goal was to address stigma in faith communities. And I didn't know what was going to happen the first year. I just reached out to different friends, say, hey, interested in just working together on this awareness day. So we had a founding group of people. It was basically myself, Dr. Lucius Burley, Cedric Pulliam, Reverend Pastor Will Francis. We had Carrie Goodman. We had Reverend Mike Schoenemeyer. We had Elder George Kerr. And we worked together to create this awareness day. We worked with UNAIDS, PEPFAR, Human Rights Campaign, AIDS United, AIDS Healthcare Foundation, different groups here in DC and nationally to kind of work together. And we had a reception at Human Rights Campaign. They had a nice event space there, and they gave it to us in kind to use that space. And literally we had people show up from all faiths. It was such a beautiful, beautiful sight to see. And it really showed the importance of unity, how you come together to talk about something that's so important to all of our faiths. And then we had a walking rally the next day to Freedom Plaza. And I mean, we didn't have a huge turnout, which is okay, but it was still good to come together. But online reached over 150,000 people in the first year. And we were really excited about it. Like, wow, we had ambassadors come in from all over. Like, we had, you probably know DeAndre Moore, he came in from Texas. We had Shalom, Julian Beckham came from Florida. We had Priya, who's Sikh, she came from Maryland. We had Saravan, who's Hindu. We had Pastor Will come from Atlanta. So people came across the US to DC for a training to become ambassadors to Faith Awareness Day. So through their help, we reached people across the US. We went back to their different states and started their communities to have their own local awareness days as well. So yes, we have Sultana in New York. I can't remember the name of it, but a really huge Black organization, Black-led organization in New York. So anyway, we reached a lot of people, and the goal was just to address stigma. People using the hashtag, we were able to find other events we didn't even know about, and we shared those events. And thankfully, last year, like, it became an officially recognized Awareness Day on HIV.gov. It's like, yes, we've actually made it on HIV.gov. We're so excited about that. It was like 3 years in the making. But now it's official awareness day on there. People can go like find like the logo to use it. They can find information to do their own awareness day. And we're planning something big this year with Southern AIDS Awareness Day as well. So stay tuned because they're really close. They're on the 20th and we're on the 29th this year. So they're really close. So we're going to work together to do some stuff. So stay tuned on that.
So what's the day again? Could you give the day
it's
again?
It's the last Sunday of every August. So our date changes every year. So this year that will be on the 29th.
Okay, the last Sunday in August is Faith HIV AIDS Awareness Day.
Well,
congratulations on getting that off the ground. I mean, I think the partnerships you talked about in doing that and the bringing folks together, I mean, it really is a lot of the themes that we like to touch on in this podcast. And so it's really nice to hear that there's an awareness day that's focused on folks of faith. I'm curious on, you know, how the last year has been, not just with that particular awareness day, but really with all of your outreach and education given COVID. And so talk to us a little bit about how COVID has impacted kind of like your work and your advocacy and the things that you were doing, you know, before this time a year ago.
Yeah, with Faith Awareness, they usually do things in person, right? So we couldn't do that this year. We did everything virtually. And, you know, it was fine. We had like, but we did a lot. We did too much, I think, because like we got burnt out. We had like events like every day for like a week. so we had online like StreamYard sessions and different speakers coming in. We had people from Black AIDS, people from Positive Women Network. We had congressional members. We had community advocates, activists, we had people living with HIV, people with different faiths. I mean, it was nice, but it just a lot. But we got a good amount of traction. So we kind of just moved from on the ground to online. And the good part was we reached more people because it was online. So you reach more people that way, they were able to check it out and see what we were doing. But as I mentioned, you mentioned in my bio, I also do wedding and event childcare. So that took a hit because I couldn't do in-person childcare. Actually, we brought a childcare for the U.S. NICE conference on HIV. We brought childcare for them. And that was really fun and a great experience. So we do kind of intersect now, HIV and AIDS too, and the childcare that I do, because I do it for different people that are in the HIV community. So anyway, we took a hit. In 2019, we were busy. We were so happy, excited for 2020. I think I was going to do really great this year, do a lot more different things. And nope. COVID said, hold my drink, let me tell you, it's not going to happen. Sit down.
We all had big plans.
But my advocacy still continue. Like I mentioned, I'm the safe ambassador with the COVID-19 Prevention Network. So Reverend Evelyn Sanders and Dr. Stefan Wallace. Dr. Wallace works with the Fred Hutch COVID-19 Prevention Trials Network. And Reverend Evelyn Sanders is a really well-known faith leader in our community. So he gathered up a bunch of people from different faith backgrounds that do work in the HIV field. And had us talk about how we can really talk about COVID-19 education in our community, especially Black communities. We know that sometimes we have barriers to access education, or we might have mistrust due to vaccines, due to our history, or we might not know certain things that other people might know. Like we might have, you know, our focus is more on trying to feed our families or survive, you know, or keep a roof over our head. Different things. So we sat down now, and we came together, we worked with Black scientists, Black doctors, and we have a whole plethora of information on COVID-19. So about six of us are faith ambassadors. We're faith throughout the U.S. And our goal is to educate our communities on COVID-19 and provide information on it. So I want to do it in a creative way. Like I want to say, here's COVID information, read this. Like, no. So what I ended up doing, I had a very short series for like maybe six episodes where it was called Iman, which means faith in Arabic. So Iman and COVID, Reflections for the Muslim Community. And every week from November to the end of December, I had a topic like healing and COVID, like what we're doing, like what are we doing to keep ourselves sane? I had COVID and politics, like what's happening right now, the election is going on, how are we feeling? Talked about sex and HIV and COVID. We had a conversation about that. So I wanted to bring in COVID, but along with topics people actually care about. So we had these discussions along with COVID, and we got some really good traction. But our biggest event that went really, really well was in January. It was called Islam, COVID-19, Vaccines, and Mistrust. Everybody, their mother was on that live. And we had like so many questions coming in. I was like, woo. But it was a really good discussion about maybe eight people on your panelists. Like we had doctors, we had faith leaders, we had nurses, public health professionals, and we had community members. And it wasn't tell you, oh, hey, you should do this or do that. The point was to kind of have a conversation. So folks make their own informed decision about COVID, about the COVID vaccine, why we have this mistrust, why it's okay. Like, reasoning why we have mistrust based on our history, what happened with Tuskegee, all the different things like that. So that's what I do now. So I think in a way, my advocacy work has been amplifying a bit because of the COVID-19 network and also doing more things online. So in a way, there is some positivity where like people are using online more, they're coming to online platforms more. So you can reach people outside of your regular network. So yeah, I think it's been helpful in some ways. I mean, COVID is not helpful at all, but like the virtual aspect of being online, reaching folks has increased.
And I would definitely say, if nothing else, this year has taught us all that we have to shift, like that there has to be, it is no longer business as usual. And it just happened so quickly. And we've adapted, and there have been more opportunities to amplify causes, voices, and reach more people. So one, kudos to you for your series and just bringing the people together and making that happen. But speaking of that COVID shift, like how do you do it? I mean, all of the things, professional superhero, activist, entrepreneur, motherhood, all of the things. How do you balance all of the things?
I think with this year, since I didn't have to do playtime sitters because COVID, I had time to do other things. So I don't do them all at one time. That would be really difficult to do. But I really got more, like if you asked me like a year ago if I'll get the vaccine, I'll tell you, hell no. I would tell you that because I don't know about this vaccine. Mm-hmm. No, I'm not really a big fan of vaccines. And so I'll tell you no. But then, you know, I learned more about it. And also, unfortunately, I lost two members of my family. Mm. And it really made me reflect more about this and the seriousness of COVID. And then I started talking to doctors about it, scientists. I wanted to learn myself. Like, I hear things growing up about vaccines are this and that. And, you know, you don't, the medical community or the government is not for Black people, which they aren't in many ways. Right. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to learn more about it. So my being part of this network, I was able to just have access to information that I wouldn't have had before. And like educating myself made me change my mind. I had my first dose for the COVID-19 vaccine. I go back in about a couple of weeks. And, you know, when I got there, I'm not going to tell you, I felt nervous. I did.
Yeah.
And I sat down in that chair and I was like, I saw her. I said, I feel nervous. She's like, oh, I understand. It's okay. And she was very sweet, the nurse. And they made you feel very relaxed and very welcoming there. And, you know, it was a really efficient process and it went very smoothly. I took my mom to get her vaccine. She's 65 and older, like a month before. So I was there for her. She took it and I kept an eye on her and all that stuff. So, you know, I ended up doing it. And because I'm trying to, like, I want to talk about believing in science and hopefully ending this pandemic.
Yes. Yes.
Over our lives, you know? Yeah. So I think it's important, and if people are interested in talking about COVID-19, like, again, I'm part of the network, so we definitely can set up lives and give you information you might want to talk about with your community. We have it in Spanish, we have it in different languages too, and we have scientists that can, like, we have Black scientists, Latino scientists, that if you want to use those for your community, talk to your community, you can do that and set that up. If you have questions that your community has, like sometimes, you know, with faith leaders, people look up to them for support and like leadership, because they are the leaders of their community. But sometimes they don't have right information when it comes to science or when it comes to different things. So it's okay to kind of connect with people to give you the information so you can talk to your congregation about it. So we have that. I mean, we're willing to help if we can. I think it's important to have information that you make your own informed decision, because COVID is here and it's not going anywhere right now. So together we can actually prevent it. So, yeah.
How do you want to define your legacy? Or when people talk about Khadijah Abdullah 30, 40, 50 years from now, because they will.
I'm old.
Even 80, 90 years from now. I mean, just how do you want to be remembered? What is your legacy? What do you hope to leave behind?
And I'm sorry, and before you end, you're not retiring, are you? Because Bianca phrased that question like you're about to like go out the door.
No, but I think as professional superheroes, we are in this for a reason, right? And so it's kind of going back to the why and the heart of the heart of why we're doing this work. What did you say?
I'm not retiring, no. We just started.
Exactly.
To be clear, Khadijah's not going anywhere. We just want to get her on the record.
She's not going anywhere. And she's definitely leaving a stamp on the world. So how are you building that legacy?
I don't want people to remember Khadijah specifically. I want people to remember the work, like what they can do to address stigma, how they can have conversations, how they can be supportive of other people. I mean, I know we already have that information, but I think it's important that people remember the work, you know, people are doing in the community. You have to remember me, Khadija, personally, because it's not about Khadija. It's about what we can do to address HIV stigma, to protect women and girls from FGM/C, to talk about sexual health, to break down barriers and, you know, use culture sometimes and how that can sometimes prevent us from moving forward and, you know, how we can give people access to care and how we can address COVID-19. How can we stay alive and healthy? Those are things and how we can do good and be compassionate and merciful, because none of us are perfect. And, you know, we have no right to judge someone else or to think that we're better than somebody else or that, you know, we don't have that right. So the goal is just humanity and just being kind to each other and supporting each other, whether we are HIV positive or not, and what we can do to create safe spaces and how we can be part of this work. And I want this cycle to continue. Like in our faith, we have something called a sadaka jabiria, which means the good deeds continue even after you pass away. So when I pass away, I want Rahma to still be here doing stuff, continue building and hopefully doing good in the community. And I want Playtime Theater to still be going on and bringing fun and smiles to kids. And I want, you know, I just want all these things to continue happening. So hopefully I'm able to build a strong foundation where Rahma still exists. But we know a lot of times nonprofits, they fizzle out.
Yeah, right? For sure.
So hopefully I'm building, like, you know, for example, Us Helping Us. And that's been around for a long time.
Bianca, can you say a word on Us Helping Us? I feel like maybe you used to.
That is literally how Khadija and I met.
Yes. And Ron Simmons, you know, he's passed on, but the work, he built a legacy, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh my God. I'm so glad you brought up. I didn't mean to cut you off, Khadija, but you mentioned someone that I have so much affinity for. Dr. Simmons was an amazing person. Mm-hmm. And talk about a legacy. Yes, that is the perfect person to think about in terms of legacies. Anyway, I just could not let that moment pass without showing my affection for him.
That's what I mean. Like, the same thing. I want to do something with Rahma. Like, I want to build something. And even I'm long gone, it's still doing impactful and powerful work in the community and being a space people can come and feel welcome. Like Dr. Simmons, he created a space for people to feel welcome and at home.
Yep.
Right. So like, I want to be able to do that. And I'm telling you, I made a lot and I continue to think people on the way, like mistakes, because I'm nowhere near perfect. People have called me out, said, hey, this is discriminatory. This is not LGBT friendly. This and that. I'm like, okay, let me change it. How can I make this more, you know, how can I change the wording? How can I make things a little bit different? So I always look for advice because I want to make sure I'm doing things where it is inclusive and it's a safe space. So I want people to call me out when I'm doing things wrong or saying things that are stigmatizing. You know, I want to learn that so I can make sure that I'm not even doing it again in the future. So that's the whole thing. It's all about the learning process. It's all about growing. And I never want to have this big head. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm all this. And no, I don't want to have that type of experience. Like, it's not what I want to be. I want to be like, I want to hopefully, I pray that I can be humble and be receptive and able to listen and learn and grow, because it's not about Khadija or what she does. It's about the community. Only we can do it together. So that's what I'm looking for. Hopefully that legacy, or maybe if I'm able to build one, can just continue over the years.
How do you take care of yourself?
That's a good question. And unfortunately, I'll tell you that sometimes I don't. I don't. Like, you know, like I said, I mentioned I lost my family member, my cousin, last October. And we were like sisters. She was just barely 30 years old. We were like sisters. We grew up together. And she left behind my nephew. He's like 4. And I took it really hard. And like, I literally just started eating a lot of food and different things to kind of deal with it. And I learned sometimes that I don't deal with things. I kind of push them off to the side, or I get myself engaged in a lot of work to think about things. So after her death, you saw me on lives everywhere. You saw me, because I was trying to escape. if people don't see that, I think, oh, she's doing this. And no, it's me, sometimes me escaping, not having to deal with things going on in my personal life. And, you know, just most recently, like, I was doing so much, like, sometimes I don't even put, like, take care of my own body. Like, I need to, like, sometimes put Vaseline on my ashy skin. I don't have time to do that.
Moisturize, sis. Moisturize.
Bianca can relate.
Goodbye. Go ahead.
So I have to find time. I'm trying to find balance. Like, I went really hard during Black History Month with the company Launch Group that I'm with, and I was doing lives and doing all this stuff, but then I got really mentally drained and exhausted and had to take a step back. So I'm really trying to find a balance and really trying to understand that you can't help others if you don't help yourself. So I'm still trying to find that balance. I haven't found it. I'm not going to say, oh, I found it. No, I haven't.
That's honest.
I haven't found it. And it's something I'm consistently searching for. What I'm trying to do now is do most of my stuff during the day. So at nighttime, hang out with family, like at least after 6 or 7. Because I find myself doing lives at 9 o'clock at night, doing a live here. Or I'm like, this is too much. I can't be doing this consistently. Like, it's just too much. And I have to find that balance. So something I'm working on is an ever continuous process. And I can't say that I found it because I have not. But hopefully I can learn how to manage my time better. So if you have tips, I'm all ears.
None. Because I'm trying to figure out the same. Every now and then, if I squeeze in a nap, and I've been trying to rest unapologetically, that is that. Because I think I was experiencing a lot of guilt from resting on the weekends, because I was like, there's something else that I could be doing with that time. And so, yeah.
That's me, like, with emails. I'll see email come in, so like, oh, I think I should real quick. Nope, don't answer it. Wait till tomorrow during business hours. So I work myself now to answer emails now. Mm-hmm. At a certain time frame. After 7 p.m. is off. I don't want to hear it. Now, people text me, I ignore it to the next day. Like, I'm trying to really set boundaries for myself. Because if I don't, I'll constantly be on, never be off. So I'm trying to figure out, at least those are the first things I'm thinking right now. Facebook messages, all that, I'm trying to ignore it until a certain time frame. You're like, I try to email you for the past 2 weeks. I'm like, sometimes I forget though too. Like, I forget to respond. So I'm not gonna lie. But I try to find a balance. I'm trying to get a planner and a calendar to figure out, okay, this is my to-do for today. Let's get this done and then we're gonna stop. So I try different things, and hopefully I can find this consistent that I can continuously do every day. But right now I haven't just yet. It's like a work in progress.
Fair.
So this last question is one we ask to all of our guests when they come onto Southern Steep. And we want to ask you as well. What do you love about the South, and what do you want to see for the South?
I love my people. I feel like a lot of us are down here in the South, that, you know, I love the culture. I love the way people talk. I love the hospitality. I just love all the different things. Like, I love people in general, and I love learning about that. And I think we are resilient people. We know the South is very severely affected by HIV and AIDS. But we are resilient. Like, we see so many different powerful stories coming out, people doing amazing work. And again, stay tuned for Southern HIV AIDS Awareness Day coming up in August. We're trying some really amazing things to kind of amplify what's happening in the South and HIV and in faith. And I think it's important because many times people forget about the South. I think it's great that you're seeing more and more orgs and pharma companies coming in and trying to support what's going on, support the people, support initiatives, and support access to different resources and care. It's funny because I'm in Virginia, D.C., right? So I don't consider it the South sometimes. Well, I was at the South. That's like in the middle somewhere. I think of like Atlanta and like, you know, all that is the South. But, you know, living down here, it is a different vibe. Than I'm from Connecticut originally. So it's a different vibe from Connecticut. I don't know if I have the words really to say. I just think it's a great place. I don't want to go back to Connecticut. I visit my family and friends, but I still find my roots are now here. Like, I've established roots here. My foundation is now here. I built so many great connections, met so many amazing people. And I think that collectively, we can really have a really powerful impact in this work. Did you mean like in the South in regards to our work, or do you mean like just in general?
It could be either.
Either, yeah. I mean, in general, like for my faith-wise, I met a lot of people from my faith here. Like I grew up a very small community in Connecticut, mostly probably African-American. So coming here, I've been exposed to a lot more cultures. It's a very, very diverse community. There's a lot of Muslims here in the DMV area. I was able to go to different like mosques or masjids and try different foods and hear different languages, meet different people, and make lifelong friends. And it also helped me in this work too, at Rahma, because we were building these foundations. So you're trying to go to these communities and talk about HIV needs or FGM class C. It's not, I mean, you do have, sometimes you have barriers, but it's a little bit easier because you can build relationships with people there and can build trust. And I think building trust is very, very important in this work. You can't go in there saying, hey, I'm Khadija, is what I have to say. Because like, who are you? We don't know you. Like, you can't stop in here and talk about different things without building connections, relationships. So it's very helpful to have that and to learn about culture and why there are cultural barriers and different things. Because they can tell you, you can see what for your own eyes. So just generally wise, I like coming here because also I came to DC because of the HIV. It was number one. It was, it had back in 2009, I first moved here, number one in the nation for HIV, and they called it infection rates. So I moved to DC. I wanted to be right in the midst of seeing how I can hopefully have some part in addressing this epidemic. So I moved here in 2009, haven't looked back. Wow, I've been here for like how long now? 12 years? It's crazy.
It's one of those things where I, there's something about being here that holds you. Like I had originally moved here from Illinois and I was like, oh, I'm gonna go back to the Midwest. And then no, you just kind of get clamped down and it holds you. Yeah. You find community, literally roots are here.
Yeah. Now my husband, we are both from Connecticut. He moved down here too, because I was down here. We weren't married when he first moved here. We met in college and he moved down here. We just built, now we're like building our life like here in the DMV. So mom's here. So yeah, here we are.
Same. He's like, well, let me come too. Okay,
girl. We're all here. My daughter's here now.
Same again, roots.
Yeah. So I hope the interview was okay with you. I know I was talking fast a lot of times and rambling. So maybe that's some good information that you're able to use for your podcast. But good combos.
You are amazing. And we definitely want to thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing your wisdom, your story, your superhero-ness with the world. And we, you know, I think one of the things that I heard you say many times was about community and being humble and kindness and mercy. And just imagine what the world could look like if more people were living through that lens and that viewer and that purpose. So thank you. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for coming and joining us.
I have one thing. So in Islam, you know, we have our book, the Quran. We pray 5 times a day. Every time we start reading the Quran or we pray, we say, in the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. So you say, Ar-Rahma, Rahman, Ar-Rahma, over and over and over again. Every time we pray or read our holy book. So Rahma is a really major concept in the Muslim faith. It's all about mercy and seeking mercy and being kind. The Prophet Muhammad, may God have mercy on him, blessings, he said, have mercy to those on the earth, to the one above the heavens, to have mercy on you. So it's like we have to follow his example, his sunnah. His sunnah means the example of his teachings. He's all about mercy. So how can we sit here and be judgmental? You know, how can we sit here and, you know, be prideful? That doesn't show mercy. You know, there was a woman who fed a hungry dog That's a sign of mercy. And that helped her get into heaven just by having that one act of kindness. So it's like, we have to think about being merciful. And if I'm able to impact one life, I feel like I've done something. I feel like I was able to accomplish something. And hopefully it'll trickle down and impact other lives. But I keep mercy. That's our leading principle at Rahma, is to have mercy and compassion and kindness in our work, every daily work. And hopefully we keep that in our forefront, we'll be successful. So we'll see.
So nice to meet you, Khadijah.
Like, I hope to meet you in person one day when this pandemic let up a little bit.
Yep. Let's speak it into existence.
Yeah, speak into existence.
So, thank you. Yeah.
And you're in Maryland, right, Bianca?
I am. So our paths shall cross. I can't
again,
wait.
Soon.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too. All right, bye.
So it is time for the Southern Charm. In this segment, we are highlighting the work of someone or an organization that is charmingly impacting the South. This week, we're highlighting Sister Reach in Memphis, Tennessee. Founded in October 2011, Sister Reach is a grassroots nonprofit that supports the reproductive autonomy of women and teens of color, poor and rural women, LGBTQIA+ people, and their families through a framework of reproductive justice. Their mission is to empower their base to lead healthy lives, raise healthy families, and live in healthy and sustainable communities. They achieve their work through a four-pronged strategy of education, policy and advocacy, cultural shift, and harm reduction. And their goal is to reach local, regional, national, and internationally. Some of their services include free HIV testing, birth control, options counseling, adult sex education classes, and they also have a reproductive justice and faith curriculum training as part of their faith and advocacy work. We've been speaking a lot about faith today. And so I stumbled upon Sister Reach by accident online, looking for organizations specifically led by women of color. And so that's how I found out about Sister Reach. And when I was diving into their website, sisterreach.org, their Instagram page, and just the work that they've been doing, they have a Black Maternal Health Week coming up. I need to learn more about them. So my plan is to hopefully have them on a future show just to share their mission, their vision, and their work. But I think it just really reminded me that there's so many great organizations out there in the South that are doing phenomenal work to uplift their communities that we don't even know about.
That are led by women,
exactly.
Which is something that we should never stop celebrating. So I completely agree with you, Bianca. We should definitely look for an opportunity to invite them onto the podcast. It sounds like they're doing great work. Can I tell you how much I learned today from Khadijah and how much I just appreciate sharing space with her? Her story about her evolution on, you know, initially not wanting to take the vaccine and then talking about how she came around on that. I feel like that her story is a lot of people's stories, particularly in Black and Brown communities. You know, it's a tall ask to ask people to trust a system and to trust a medical infrastructure that was not built for them. You know what I mean? And so it's not surprising that there's hesitancy around the COVID vaccine, but I love the way that she talked about how she dealt with that, because I feel like a lot of people, candidly, are dealing with that, struggling with that same thing right now.
Absolutely. And I think just the amount of education and effort that folks in community on the ground are doing in order to not only educate and inform themselves, but their family members, their faith communities, their, you know, their neighbors, et cetera, just there's so much information out there, true information about science, about public health, about what we need to do, that it's really important to get it out there in ways that are digestible, because I think that's huge. Like, who is the messenger? How are they telling me about these things in order to make folks able to understand why this is important, why this vaccine is important, how we got here, et cetera, what we need to do to protect ourselves and loved ones. So I think it's great to have folks like Khadija who are honest about their experience, but also are doing something in order to help and uplift and change lives.
Agreed. So another Southern Steep in the books.
We did it. It reunited and it feels so good.
A great song.
I don't own the rights to that. That's why I didn't sing it. That's why I just said it.
I'm sure NASDAQ appreciates that because we're not trying to get them sued.
You're welcome. On that note, I'm Bianca Ward.
I'm Isaiah Webster. Thanks for listening.